Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's show of Taboo No More, a production of One World Communication in association with People to People. Taboo No More is a talk show about mental health issues and sensitive topics that people often feel uncomfortable talking about. It's a chance to hear from experts, ask questions, and hear about situations that may affect your life in some way. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Hoffman, and tonight we'll be discussing dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Joining us tonight is our expert, Dr. Jonas Gedda, professor of neurology and psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic on cognitive impairment and dementia. Dr. Jonas is a fellow of the American Neuropsychiatric Association and currently chairman of the Academy of Psychosomatic Medicine. Dr. Jonas is very involved in clinical educational research activities, has published many articles on lifestyles and neuropsychiatric symptoms of brain aging and mild cognitive impairment. Welcome tonight, Dr. Jonas. We're glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. We were going to have another guest, Dr. Steve Toll, to talk about the role of music. He was not able to join us tonight. But we'll ask Dr. Jonas to touch on that subject as we get deeper into our topic tonight. So, Dr. Jonas, thanks so much for joining us tonight. And we'd like to hear a little bit about, first, if you can tell us what you do in your role at Mayo Clinic, and then we'll go into a little bit about dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
Thank you, Dr. Jeff. My role here at Mayo Clinic, actually, it started in 1996, I started out with training in psychiatry, and then after psychiatry, I did a year and a half of fellowship in behavioral neurology, and I have been a full-time faculty at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, from 2001 up to 2011, and then I transferred to Mayo Clinic in Arizona in 2011, August of 2011. And my role is I'm a consultant in the Department of Psychiatry and Psychology. Additionally, I also have appointment in the Department of Neurology. And in the medical school, my academic rank is Professor of Neurology and Psychiatry, so in both disciplines. Really, I see patients, I teach medical students, I do research, and I divide my time between 50% research and the remaining for education and clinical care.
Oh, that's excellent. We feel very honored to have you on the show tonight. And clearly, Mayo Clinic is one of the top medical institutions in the country, so we're glad to have an expert such as yourself to talk about this subject that affects so many people's lives today, and more we hear about the increase of incidence of Alzheimer's and dementia, and Alzheimer's disease can be such disabling diseases and can be such a challenge for family members to deal with. So why don't we get started, and if you could tell us a little bit about what exactly is dementia? What does that mean when someone is getting dementia?
So dementia, we can think of dementia to be a chronic brain failure. You know, the analogy or the metaphor we can take will be from kidney failure. For example, there is acute kidney failure and there is chronic kidney failure. Similarly, dementia, we can think of it as a chronic brain failure, and whereas delirium or acute encephalopathy, we can think of it as acute brain failure. So basically, dementia involves really two major issues. The number one issue is the person develops relatively gradual, insidious onset and gradual progression of loss of cognitive function. And what are these cognitive functions? Number one, language. The left part of the brain usually processes language. The right side of the brain processes sense of direction. And the frontal part of the brain processes judgment. And then at the middle of the brain is about learning and memory and recall. So when a person develops this impairment in this cognitive function, and as a result of that, when the person is unable to function independently, for example, simple things as activities of daily living will be compromised due to dementia, things like cooking, driving car, and even as the disease advances, the person may get even be lost in their own house, let alone in their, so being lost on the highways of America, it doesn't count. Obviously, we all get lost. But to be lost in one's own neighborhood where one has lived for 20, 30 years. So these types of signs and symptoms are suggestive of dementia.
So it's a gradual progression. Loss of cognitive functioning, cognitive abilities, and language, sense of direction, judgment, memory, learning, a gradual decline in all of these functions.
Exactly. And this leads to a departure from baseline, a departure from baseline of a person's ability to function independently. So as the disease progresses, the person becomes almost finally dependent even for simple activities such as eating food become difficult and impossible. The person has to be fed and taken care of by others. So as the disease progresses, So functional loss combined with cognitive impairment,
Loss of function and loss of independent ability to handle daily living skills. So what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
Very good. So actually, let us think of a set theory or Venn diagram. So let us draw a big circle. So that big circle will be dementia. And dementia can be caused by various things. And there are several causes. For example, a person who was functioning independently, let's say a 70-year-old person is going to work, doing her duty or his duty very well, independent, suddenly the person will have significant bleeding in the brain, stroke, that can lead to dementia. And that will be dementia due to stroke or bleeding in the brain.
Right.
But if you take the set, the big circle, as 100, the big circle, and usually about 60% of the cause of dementia, most of the cause is due to Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
The next question is, what is Alzheimer's disease, as you say?
Yes.
Alzheimer's disease is named after Alwa Alzheimer, and in 1906, there was a conference in Tübingen, Germany. At that conference in Tübingen, Germany, a scientist who was trained, a neuropsychiatrist from Munich, he presented his data. His data was based on findings from a lady called Frau D. He called her Frau D., Mrs. D., and this lady, at the age of 56, she presented to his clinic with a few complaints. She said her husband is cheating on her. She said other people are trying to hurt her, harm her, and she became extremely suspicious. And then she developed what is called delusion of infidelity when her husband was actually by her side, you know, 24/7. She always accused him that he spent most of the time with other women. And then after that, she started developing problems with remembering, you know, forgetfulness for recent events and future engagements. So then this led to eventually her language started to become problematic. And then she started getting lost. And finally, she was not able to swallow food. She was not able to have reflexes and various things. Finally, she died. When she died, Dr. Alzheimer, what he did is he asked for autopsy, and then he looked at the brain, and then he found two findings. It's called tangles and plaques and tangles. He found that the nerve cells of Frau D contained some abnormal aggregate of proteins, which he called tangles. And then in between nerve cells, he found some plaques, you know, kind of the kind of dirt and that accumulates between nerve cells. And he reported this, and then he said a clinical manifestation of insidious onset and gradual progression of dementia. And when the person died, neuropathologically finding plaques and tangles, this constitutes a disease. And the world called it now Alzheimer's disease. So really, essentially, Alzheimer's disease is the commonest cause of dementia. It is a subset of dementia.
Okay, so it's one of the causes of dementia. It has these plaques and tangles. Would you say, are the delusions that this woman reported of sexual cheating, were those symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, or can those be symptoms of general dementia?
So the psychiatric symptoms, depression, apathy, paranoia, delusion, psychosis, hallucination, all of them can be seen in dementia, depending on what stage the patient is. So we can see it in all forms of dementia, Alzheimer's dementia. There's another entity called Lewy body dementia. And interestingly, by the way, Alois Alzheimer, Friedrich Lewy, and a number of these investigators, they were actually at that same conference, at the Tübingen conference. If your audience is interested, you know, if you Google 1906 Tübingen, T-U-B-N-G-E-N, conference of dementia or Alzheimer, you can see the picture of this really amazing intellectuals. They made observation in 1906, and now the number one cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. The number two is Lewy body dementia. So it's really fascinating how dedicated the research did that. Yeah.
Would you say, are there any? So Alzheimer's is a disease that is one of the causes of dementia, and then there are these others. Are there any clinical differences between Alzheimer's and dementia? Are there any things that differentiate them from their symptoms?
So essentially, dementia is a blanket diagnosis. So that is a bigger picture. So if a person develops problems with cognitive function, and that decline in cognitive function leads to substantial decline in day-to-day functioning, you call that dementia.
Right.
And then you go into the details. You know, you try to sort it out. It's really like if you take Ethiopia. So being Ethiopian is the total identity for all of us, for all Ethiopians. And then if you go by regions, then there will be Addis Ababa, etc. And then let's say there is Oromia. It is it covers most of, let's say, Ethiopia. That will become analogous to Alzheimer's. And then the name Ethiopia will be the bigger set, so dementia. That's how I see it. You know, it's a metaphor
right.
to use is the bigger picture is dementia, and then there are the specific causes are Alzheimer's, dementia, and other things. Yeah.
Yes, but is there any way to determine whether someone has Alzheimer's before they die? I mean, obviously, when they die, you can see from their brain that it has these abnormal plaques and tangles, but are there ways to diagnose Alzheimer's before a person dies if they know what type of dementia it is?
You have you raised a very important question, Dr. Jeff. Clinically, based on clinical evaluation, you can have a very good, depending on how the clinical skill of the person is, you can guess up to 80% time you can accurately guess that the person may have Alzheimer's disease. But really, the definitive diagnosis has to always wait until the person dies, and then you look at the brain.
Uh-huh.
But in 2004, a person, an American scientist, physician scientist called Dr. Bill Klunk, he is a psychiatrist with additional training in neuroscience, MD, PhD. He was at Washu University in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes.
And then subsequently, he moved to University of Pittsburgh. He came up with a technology to look at amyloid or this plaque, or this chemical that leads to the plaque.
Yes.
He was able to use a technology called Pittsburgh compound. You inject this tracer into the blood vessel of the person, and then through the blood, this tracer goes to the brain, and then it binds to this amyloid, and it lights up. So this is one of the promising technologies. So really, everybody wants to know whether we can use brain imaging technology to make
right.
a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease before the person dies. And we are making progress in that direction.
Uh-huh. Well, that brings us to the question of treatment. Are there medical or other types of treatments for Alzheimer's specifically or dementia more generally?
This is really dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Both of them really require a multidisciplinary approach. It is a true teamwork.
Yes.
You need to have psychologists, you need to have physicians, psychiatrists, neurologists, geriatricians, nurses, all of them working together as a team, because dementia has lots of multidisciplinary problems. So if you take, for example, a behavioral approach, there are various studies done. One of them that I remember is from the University of Washington in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association.
Yes.
A psychologist from University of Washington in Seattle, Professor Terry, she reported using a behavioral approach to dementia, and since then various people have now pursued different types of behavioral approach to manage dementia, including research done at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. The neuropsychologist Dr. Glenn Smith and colleagues have come up with a behavioral approach called DBART and various other approach. That is a behavioral aspect. But in terms of medication, really, the medication that is used widely is called Aricept, A-R-I-C-E-P-T, or donepezil, and neurologists and psychiatrists and internists, others, they prescribe it for patients with Alzheimer's disease. It at least it delays the progression of the disease. It is not a cure.
Uh-huh.
But at this point, to be honest with you, there is no breakthrough. There is no medication that can arrest the progression of the disease.
When you say it can delay, this medication can delay the progression, are you saying can it delay it years or months, or is it just you know, a very modest type of a delay?
I think from months to years. You know, like if you use the placement in a nursing home as one of your outcome measures,
yes,
it might be able to delay it by a few months to a year or so.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I agree, it is not really an earth-shattering medication, but that's what we have at this time.
Now, when you say a behavioral treatment, can you elaborate on that a little bit? What do you mean by behavioral? Is it like teaching them memory skills, learning skills? Is it challenging the brain cognitively? I've heard if people play music, or what are the behavioral things that people can do to address this?
I think that depends on the stage of the disease.
Okay.
So now really the field, let's say in the 1980s, the focus of the field is to define dementia. What is dementia? How do we define it? And in 1984, the National Institute of Health, you know, particularly the stroke group, came up with the criteria. And then in 1994, you know, the American Psychiatric Association came up with other criteria. So the initial step was to understand dementia. And now people say, hold on, they said, hold on. It's too late. By the time a person has dementia, we need to find high-risk group for dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And there is an entity called mild cognitive impairment.
Right.
It's really an early stage, or it is a risk group for dementia / Alzheimer's disease, MCI. And it's the major work was done at Mayo Clinic. My mentor, Dr. Ron Peterson, did most of the work. And that group has early symptoms, but an individual with MCI is able to function, but maybe forgetful for recent events, etc. And then now the current tendency is we need to use imaging technology, neuropsychological testing, various techniques of even identifying someone when we see a 70-year-old person. The person could be normal. When we do imaging, is Alzheimer's disease percolating in the brain of the person?
Uh-huh.
So what we did, actually one of my research is trying to prevent these things from happening. And to be honest with you, really, we in our field, so much millions of dollars were invested to use medication to prevent dementia. There is no breakthrough.
Yes.
No, nothing has been identified. However, physical exercise, studies
physical
done
exercise.
In Chicago and other places, and we have published a paper in 2010 in Archives of Neurology. I'm the first author on that. And also mentally stimulating activities. In 2011, you know, one summer research student, Hilary Topazian and myself and others, we did some work, whether playing piano or reading books, or reading newspaper, etc., could be beneficial. And then several studies also, particularly in New York and at Mayo, we looked at also at caloric intake. You know, so these types of lifestyle factors, it's really amazingly they come up with consistent message. You know, physical activity, particularly regular walking and swimming, regular biking, are associated with decreased risk of dementia or even pre-dementia state. It decreases the risk.
Uh-huh.
So these are really, I'm sorry, I don't have any earth-shattering information, really. The good old physical exercise continues to be beneficial even to prevent dementia.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What about meditation? Has meditation been studied for preventing this?
So these days there is an interest on mindfulness and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some ongoing research on this. I'm interested. For example, there is this. I was at one conference and I observed there is this intervention that uses meditation and different combinations for other conditions. There are ongoing studies, and it seems to be really promising. But if you consider meditation as a mentally stimulating activity, intellectually stimulating activity, yes, it has.
Uh-huh.
You know, there have been publications in their benefits. But meditation specifically, there are some reports. But obviously, I think. To be honest with you, in order to say meditation could prevent dementia, we need more data.
We don't know yet. Now, I also heard that there is some research being done using brain stimulation through like cranial electric stimulation, mild electrical stimulation. Are you familiar? Is that something that?
I'm familiar with that, yes. There is an ongoing study. I think the primary site of study is in Canada, and then some of the centers, you know, here even in BNI, Barrow Neurological Institute, and others are involved. It's really at a very rudimentary stage.
Yes, okay.
Really
at
this time, the most robust finding is from the good old lifestyle factors,
Right.
physical activities, that type of thing.
Well, it sounds a little bit discouraging in some ways that, you know, there's not a lot we can do to change the course, to predict or diagnose or change the course of this disease in any dramatic or substantial way. For the next few minutes, I'd like to talk about, so how do we cope with this? I just want to mention to our listeners that in a few minutes we'll open up the telephone line, and that number is 646-595-4742. We'll open up the line in a few minutes. You dial that number, and then you press 1 to speak to the moderator to be able to ask your question. But let's just talk for a few more minutes about, given the challenge of this disease and dementia, this cognitive decline, people lose memory. In fact, my father was just visiting me here, and he's in his late 70s. He's showing signs of cognitive decline, I guess you could say. You know, he keeps repeating himself, some memory problems. It's not dramatic. It sounds like it would fit into your mild cognitive impairment, and it may be due to he drinks too much over the years. That may contribute to it. But you start to see these things happening in your family members and your friends. What are some of the things family members can do? What can we do to deal with these, to cope with these situations?
So I will answer that, what the family members can do. I will address that. But before that, I just want to make sure that I have communicated my thoughts clearly. In terms of, we are able to diagnose dementia reasonably well.
Okay.
We can diagnose mild cognitive impairment reasonably well.
Yes.
We can even predict, you know, what percent of people with MCI will eventually develop dementia. We can tell a person with MCI, with mild cognitive impairment, you know, from the data we have so far, you know, there is a 15% per year risk of developing dementia. So we can do all these predictions. The key challenge is that we have not come up with a treatment that can arrest the progression of the disease.
Right.
Nothing.
So we can diagnose it, but we still can't treat it effectively.
Exactly. We can't stop it. We can't stop the trend.
We can delay.
We can, you know, that type of thing. But it keeps progressing. So that's one.
So what can we do? Yeah.
Exactly. What is it that family members and healthcare providers can do? That depends on the stage of the cognitive impairment.
Okay.
For example, for mild cognitive impairment, for MCI, there are various trials. There are medication trials going on. There are also behavioral training trials. For example, just to mention the study at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Glenn Smithy has developed an intervention called HABIT, H-A-B-I-T. You know, it uses, you know, memory, education, various, you know, yoga and meditation, the things you mentioned. A combination of these things are used by Dr. Smith and team to delay progression. And the other thing is, one thing we can never underestimate is that family members have access to resources. For example, Alzheimer's Association has runs national support groups throughout the United States. And these support groups identify, you know, specific problems with a specific family or group at a specific stage, and they try to tailor different coping strategies within that context. And but there are some general truths. For example, arguing with a patient with Alzheimer's dementia, family members trying to convince a person to remember, these types of futile efforts actually will tend to contribute to escalation of symptoms, agitation, guilt, and depression.
So you can't talk someone out of it.
Yeah, that's, you know, why really that is the key, assuming
right.
the diagnosis is made correctly. And the other thing, of course, is the family members, when they notice, you know, manageable, treatable conditions like depression, anxiety, agitation, then they need to work, you know, closely with healthcare providers.
Uh-huh.
To address these issues. And the other thing is really family members themselves, there is one thing I advise is what they call it respite. You know,
if one
family member is just doing the care for a parent with dementia, then we have observed that up to 50% of care providers sometimes develop depression. So family members need to be realistic. They need to take a break, they need to rotate, they need to switch to rotations, you know, somebody should cover for some time. That is very important, you know.
You have to share the responsibilities. It's
exactly.
important to take yeah. turns, to help each other, not to put all the burden on one person. And probably caretakers have to follow the same guidelines of physical exercise, nutrition, and mental stimulation to keep themselves healthy for caregiving.
Absolutely. Actually, one metaphor I use when I meet with family members is that, you know, in airplane, when we travel in airplane, if there is a loss of pressure, you know, the stewards would tell us, you know, if there is loss of pressure in the airplane, first put the mask on yourself. You get oxygen, then you put it on the other person. So
right.
if you really want to help a family member with dementia, the family member itself has to get respite and do, you know, health-promoting activities.
Right, take care of themselves first. Well, that is an excellent overview, and let's break for a minute here to see if we have any callers here. Let me remind our listeners again, the number is 646-595-4742, and you have to press 1 to get the moderator. This is the show Taboo No More. a production of One World Communication in association with People to People. Okay, do we have any callers on the line? Okay, we'll wait a second, see if anyone is called in there.
Probably it is very clear, so maybe the people thought it is so clear they don't need to ask questions. Huh?
Yeah, it is very clear. Is there a caller on the line? I have a
hello?
Question. Yes, we do have a caller on the line. Hello there. Good evening. Hello, are you there? We had a caller there. Are you still on the line? Dr. Jonas?
Yes, I'm still there. Yeah.
I think we have a caller, but they may have been disconnected.
Okay.
While we give it a minute, I have a question for you. Aside from the mild cognitive impairment, once you have the mild cognitive impairment and you realize that this person is heading in this direction, are there any other risk factors for getting dementia or Alzheimer's? Are there things that might predisposition someone?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So one of the area of research is trying to find out if there is any genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease or dementia. So really, if you have, let's say, 100 individuals with Alzheimer's disease, you know, maybe two or three of them are due to direct genetic causes. You know, there is an entity
uh-huh.
called presenilin-1, presenilin-2. So those are, but most other types of Alzheimer's dementia is what we call quote-unquote wild type. It just happens. And there may be a family history of Alzheimer's dementia, but really you do not see this direct Mendelian inheritance. For example, you know, if you take the disease, a neurological condition called Huntington disease, we know exactly it is caused by genetic risk. You know, Huntington chromosome number 4. If you have a certain gene, then you will produce too much of a bad proteins that accumulate in the brain and leads to different things. But Alzheimer is not like that. That makes it complicated. So. One of the risk factors for sure we have identified is called APOE4. So this is apolipoprotein E4. So in our body, in the blood, there are like transporters. It's like you can think of it like a truck. This truck transports from one part of the liver to different parts of the places. It moves around this the apolipoprotein, and then one of them, this E4 gene, if a person has this E4 gene, let's say a person inherits one gene from father, and if the person is unlucky enough to get another gene from the mother, the
uh-huh.
risk increases. But again, it doesn't mean the person will definitely have Alzheimer's. So E4,
okay.
E4 gene is one risk factor. But by and large, really,
yes.
We really, to be honest with you, it is idiopathic. We really don't know why
uh-huh.
most people develop Alzheimer's dementia. But risk factors, you know, depression is suspected. You know, some people
yes.
have even looked into cholesterol and less physical activity, less mentally stimulating activities. And
uh-huh.
another important thing is isolation and loneliness, and you know, some elderly people they live alone, you know, in one
uh-huh.
place, and the next neighbor could be 10 kilometers away, and these types so social network is another protective factor. So
people need people.
Exactly. Actually, really, there are several studies particularly one good study from Australia has shown, you know, social network seems to be very useful, very protective.
Okay. Great.
So really,
well, I do think we have a couple of callers on the line, I understand from our host here. So do we have a caller on the line right now?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Jonas. My question kind of relates to Dr. Hoffman's question. I work with a lot of clients who have been exposed to severe trauma, like TBI, like traumatic brain injury. I'm wondering if that's a risk factor.
Absolutely. So this is a very good question. I didn't catch your name, the person who asked the question. So,
Helena.
Helena, okay.
Yes.
So Helena's question is very important. So traumatic brain injury, TBI, is one of the first risk factors investigated. In fact, when I took, after medical school, after residency, when I took the clinical research training, one of the classic papers we have discussed was in the 1980s, a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, I think he's now at the University of South Florida, he conducted a case control study. So what he did was very simple study in the 1985 or something, and he took, I don't know, maybe 70 people with Alzheimer's disease, and then matched them with 17 individuals without Alzheimer's disease. And then he went back and looked at their medical record to find out how many of them have had history of head injury. And definitely this person identified, Dr. Mortimer, Professor Mortimer, he identified that head injury is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Obviously, that paper was challenged by others, but at least that was probably the first paper that addressed the question of Helena in 1986 by Mortimer. And then later on, other people have done similar research. So, yeah, the bottom line is some sort of injury, mm-hmm. be it due to stroke, be it due to motor vehicle accident, be it due to some sort of injury to the brain, might predispose a person to dementia, not necessarily to Alzheimer's dementia, but to it could be a risk factor for dementia. However, we have to know that it's incredible how human beings vary. There are some individuals who have been at a battlefront, who had, I had patients actually, who had head injury with multiple fragments in their brain, and still functioning well, independent, and productive. So really, the resilience, there is a theory, cognitive reserve, brain reserve.
Right.
I think the human will, the psychological factor of human will, has a big role, really, probably, in preventing dementia as well. So to answer Helena's question, yes, the traumatic brain injury is a risk factor.
Well, that's
thank you.
That's an excellent question. Thank you so much. And so I understand if somebody has traumatic brain injury, it could be a risk factor for dementia, but many people can have traumatic brain injury and not show any symptoms of dementia or cognitive impairment.
Absolutely. I worked as a general practitioner, and I have seen patients who did not have that.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Can you please ask your question or tell us what your situation is?
Hi, yes. My name is Kenanaya. This is an open-ended question, not for both hosts. I have a friend, and his grandfather just recently been struck with dementia. And it came soon after that his wife, which is my friend's grandmother, has died, and he wakes up in the middle of the night screaming for his wife, you know, trying to find his wife, and it's so heinous for him to have to deal with something like that. I would like to know, is there some way to slow down the process? Is there something that he could eat, or is there something that he could do?
Well, that's obviously a very tragic situation. And Dr. Jonas, how would you respond to that?
Again, this is also a very good question. I didn't catch the name of the caller.
Kenaniah.
Kenaniah. So Kenaniah's question is very important. So there are two things. Number one, perhaps your grandfather, whether did he have already a predisposing factor? For example, what I do is I order MRI of the brain. I try to look at the brain. And if there is a very substantial loss of brain tissue, perhaps there have been ongoing, there have been some brain tissue substantial loss, but the person was able to cope with that. You know, the person might have been dealing with that, able to, in spite of the neuronal loss, the person might have been functioning. However, as soon as his wife died, then the grief and depression might have precipitated the clinical manifestation. So there is a neurobiological process going on, and then there is a precipitating psychosocial stressor leading to clinical manifestation. So it is probably, I suspect, probably the Kenaniah's grandfather, he might have had, assuming it is dementia, probably he might have had an ongoing predisposing, you know, neurobiological process, and then the grief might have precipitated. The other thing is there are lookalikes to dementia. The lookalikes are severe depression with particularly psychotic features can really look like dementia. So sometimes the only way to do is, if Kenaniah's grandfather is my patient, I would first aggressively treat this as major depression with psychotic features and treat it accordingly and see how that goes. Because sometimes patients may, quote-unquote, get cured of their dementia when, in fact, it is what we call pseudo-dementia, which is severe depression with psychotic features in elderly people can present with exact dementia-like symptoms. So the first question is really to clarify their diagnosis and then to treat it for depression as well.
I wonder, too, I'm just speculating here, but I wonder if maybe the grandfather was taken care of by his wife, and, you know, maybe in her taking care of him all the time, some of his mild symptoms may not have been that noticeable because she compensated or, you know, helped him cope with things, and then her death could precipitate a sudden decline or at least an appearance of a decline in his functioning.
Right, because it's funny because actually he it was the opposite way around, but she always, no matter what, no matter how sick she got, no matter how frail she got, she was always emotionally there. Like, she always kept him going. So I always felt like she was his anchor to reality.
Yes.
So I think Dr. Jeff's point makes sense. It's a very good point. Yes, sometimes, you know, family care providers, when they pass away, then there could be unmasking of symptoms. I agree with you. It's a very, very plausible hypothesis, Dr. Jeff.
And it sounds like in this case, as you said earlier, Dr. Jonas, sometimes the will to live, the will to live a full life, to live a healthy life, sometimes can really help a person function better. And when you lose your anchor in life, the one you've loved all your life, who's been, you know, the anchor and love of your life, then that may take away that will, that desire to live, the desire to be healthy and function.
Right. I agree. Because I've noticed this about him. I don't even know if this correlates, but I noticed that when I keep him hydrated, he seems to function a lot better. Like, he seems to come to, if you know what I mean, like it's a fog, yeah. like the mental fog seems to lift just a little bit, but it makes a difference.
Dr. Jonas, have you mentioned nutrition earlier. What about hydration? Is it important to keep people hydrated, drinking lots of water, fluids, things like that?
I think, doing all the basic necessities, hydration, nutrition, I think meeting the requirements, the physiological needs of a patient without overdoing it is important. I mean, uh-huh. we don't want to give too much fluid either. I mean, excessive fluid consumption itself can lead to swelling in the brain. So there are other things, but I think meeting the physiological need is good and important. Yeah.
And what about, let's bring in the subject of music here. Is music something that could help in a situation like this? Could this help the grandfather listening to music? Is that something that can be therapeutic in some way?
So, as I mentioned to you, there are various studies, including our study that we published in 2011. In fact, there is a table. We have one table there. People who played musical instruments, piano, or listened music, or were involved in music, it seems it decreases the risk of dementia. It decreases the risk of dementia. And then but once the person has developed dementia, I think music, particularly if there is a music well known to calm down that person in the past. Some people tell you when I listen to La Honga Sesa or something, I feel calmer. Let's say somebody was saying, and then when the person gets demented, probably bringing back that music can help. Once the symptom occurs, then knowing that the habits and trends of the person has important roles.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you so much, caller, for sharing that information. I know for many listeners it helps to hear about situations that people are dealing with themselves. And again, these are not easy things to talk about. That's why we call this program Taboo No More. So thank you so much for calling in. I think we have one more caller. We'll have time for one more call. We have one more caller on the line, and then we will wrap up our conversation here on dementia and Alzheimer's with Dr. Jonas Geda. Yes, caller, please ask your question. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling.
Hello? Yes.
I was enjoying and learning quite a bit from the comments and the discussions that were going on this evening. I'm a pediatrician, and I do work with Ethiopian communities, and I'm a member of People.
Yes.
No More a Taboo is a good topic, really. And the Ethiopian community in the U.S., and I can't say for other Western countries and Western cities also, are not that much very much disposed to seeking help for mental illness.
Yes.
And I think wherever we are in different communities, there must be an approach that we should be taking to make it no more of a taboo. And this tonight's discussion is one of it, and I do appreciate that.
Let me
ask you, as what steps would the guests suggest us to make this much more open and much more reliably utilized, because of physical illnesses are coming to be less of a problem for people to seek, even though that has not gone full strength. But mental illnesses are far, far behind. I'm not saying that it has moved so fast in the Western world, and also But in our culture, it is not moving as fast as it should. I will leave for comments to the guests.
Yes, thank you so much. That's an excellent question and an excellent one for us to wind the show down with. Dr. Yonas, how would you answer that question specifically in relation to dementia and Alzheimer's disease? Do you find, especially in the Ethiopian community, that people have a hard time bringing these kinds of situations to the attention of professionals? What would you say to encourage people to get the kind of help or information that they need?
Well, thank you, Dr. Jeff. First, let me guess. I think the caller might be Dr. Kimfer, who has a long experience in medical field and public health as well. Is that correct?
Right. That's me, Dr. Yonas.
Okay. So my memory is working well.
yes.
Yeah.
So I think Dr. Kimfer raises a very serious question. So the question of stigma towards mental illness in the Ethiopian community, for that matter, you know, it's a global phenomenon. But if we compare, on average, if we compare the Ethiopian community, let's say, with American-born, you know, natives, with Americans, let's say, you know, we can reasonably guess that there might be more stigma toward this dementia or other mental illness in the Ethiopian community. I think it might be safe to say that. To be candid, you know, I need to educate myself on this. However, from day-to-day life, you know, I can guess that I want to read, the literature on this. And probably, I am sure, you know, our excellent, you know, School of Public Health during Emperor Haile Selassie's time and after that, there have been so many studies done. Maybe this could have been one of them that might have been studied. And probably Dr. Fikre Workner and others might have done some work. I need to read about that. But I believe, in general, I think there might be, there is stigma towards mental illness. So assuming that there is a serious stigma towards mental illness in the Ethiopian community, what is it that we can do? In my opinion, stigma, the degree of stigma is a reflection of the overall culture of probably tolerance and the ability to accommodate different ways of life. So this may be a marker of, in epidemiology we say, you know, something could be a marker of a symptom or a problem, could be a marker of a bigger issue. So this probably, you know, is sociological, anthropological, and, you know, that might be a public health issue. So, but I agree. I suspect there is a stigma. I think probably we need, you know, one of my heroes in the U.S. is, you know, really is Benjamin Franklin. When I read his biography, one of the things he said is, it's amazing. He said that the key to stability and economic growth to society is tolerance. He said, I mean, he said this many years ago. So I think really addressing mental health issues requires tremendous amount of tolerance. Uh-huh. It requires a tremendous amount of the ability to put oneself in the shoes of another one. And so I think my guess is, as we make progress in all aspects of our life, the issue of stigma would also improve. That's my hypothesis.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for the call, Doctor. And this is an excellent way to close our show. I want to thank Dr. Yonas for joining us tonight, Dr. Yonas Geda. It's been a very enlightening conversation, and I think the first step to addressing stigma is education and being knowledgeable about these sensitive and sometimes very difficult issues. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. I want to just mention that next week's show, hosted by Dr. Antone Haptechano. We'll be featuring a guest, Dr. Electron Kabebu, who's the head of endocrine and oncology at NIH. So this will be a very interesting discussion on the treatment, diagnosis, and prognosis of endocrine cancers next Thursday night. Taboo No More is a production of One World Communication in association with People to People. And next month, the last Thursday of the month, April 24th, we're planning to have a topic of domestic violence, which is something that can touch many people's lives, and it's a very difficult subject for many people to talk about. So we'll look forward to that topic at the end of April. Thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight, and good night. This is Dr. Jeff Hoffman of Taboo No More. Have a good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night, Dr. Jeff.